Before this, with the good old days, the current remix. Brocar before that with Kill the Ego. That's about it for me for today. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm DJ Firefly. If you missed the show, or if you want to get in touch with me, or if you can figure out what this guy needs, feel free to check out my website at djfirefly.com.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're again joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges.
Chris Hedges talks about ways to stop and reverse the rapid degeneration of the country into a squalid dictatorship, hit the streets, and above all, let's work for a general strike of labor. Next on Law and Disorder, we speak with Phil Weiss, the founder and now senior writer at Mondo Weiss, the newsletter about Palestine and Zionism. Phil Weiss wasn't always an anti-Zionist. He talks about his story. He talks about the influence that Michael Ratner had on him. Listen in. This is a terrific interview.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. Trump 2.0 is qualitatively different from his first term in office. This time, Trump and his allies have brought down a tsunami on us, creating fear and chaos. Tens of thousands of government workers have been fired. Thousands have been deported, some to a torture prison in El Salvador, without any due process. The court orders challenging this have been ignored as well. With his extreme tariff measures, Trump has damaged our economy, and it looks like there may be a recession down the road. Trump has promised to use the Army and National Guard to suppress protests. Should there be an act of violence committed by a lone wolf, Trump could use it as an excuse to invoke the Insurrection Act and call out the troops. This is all too reminiscent of what happened in Germany when a lone wolf set fire to the German Parliament building. Hitler used this as a pretext for suspending civil rights and civil liberties and outlawing the communist and socialist parties, which were then huge. Moreover, and most importantly, not only politics, but the culture of our country is being changed as well. The Department of Education has been disbanded. Books are banned. Certain words are forbidden. Universities have come under Trump's control, starting with Columbia University in New York City. The great Kennedy Center, a mecca for U.S. culture, has been taken over by Trump and his Philistine allies. So on today's show, Chris Hedges returns to Law and Disorder Radio. Mr. Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the former head of the Middle East Bureau of the New York Times. He has covered wars, revolutions, and counter-revolutions. Mr. Hedges has also written numerous books, including American Fascism, The Christian Right, and The War on America. Chris Hedges, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
The Posse Comitatus Act, which outlawed the use of the army for domestic law enforcement, has been, overturned by the courts. I think you were involved in the lawsuit that resulted in that. Talk to us about that lawsuit.
Right. So Obama, on midnight, the last day of 2011, signed the National Defense Authorization Act, which had added section in it called Section 1021, and that essentially overturned the Posse Comitatus Act. The Posse Comitatus Act was designed to prevent the federal government from using the standing army, the military, as domestic police force. We sued him in federal court in the Southern District of New York. Much to the surprise of the Obama administration and, frankly, ourselves, we won. The next day, the lawyers for the NSA and flew to New York and tried to get Catherine B. Forrest, who made the ruling, to issue a temporary injunction, meaning that they would hold off from the enforcement of that ruling. And she refused, to her credit. And they went to the appellate court, and they did get the temporary injunction. And then it was a process of many months for the appellate court. That's a three-panel judge hearing would hear our case. They waited until after a Supreme Court ruling called Amnesty International versus Clapper, or maybe it was Clapper versus Amnesty International, which I was also a part of. And that was challenging government surveillance as journalists. The government lawyers got up in the court and actually told the justices that if any of us as journalists were being monitored by the federal government, we would be informed. Well, we know after Snowden that that was completely untrue. But based on that assertion, the Supreme Court ruled against us. And then what the appellate court did, because it's a very clear constitutional issue, the appellate court waited for that ruling. And they said, well, if Hedges doesn't have standing in Clapper versus Amnesty International, therefore he doesn't have standing in Hedges versus Obama. And so essentially they denied my ability to bring the case, and it's law. We filed a cert to the Supreme Court to see if they would hear the case. They turned us down, and it is now law under a Trump administration.
Chris, you voiced fear of a blowback. You're afraid that in desperation, some individual or group of individuals will commit an act of violence that Trump can use as a pretext to invoke the Insurrection Act and thereby use the army against us. Please talk about this in the context of what Hitler did after the Reichstag fire.
I think blowback's inevitable given what we have done to the Palestinians in Gaza, and I have spent quite a bit of time in the Middle East since October 7th, two trips to Qatar to do broadcasting for Al Jazeera, two trips to Egypt. I'm about to make a third. I was in Jordan last summer and the West Bank. And quite understandably, the Arab street is enraged at this wholesale slaughter, the complicity of the United States in the genocide, the utter failure on the part of any nation, with maybe the exception of Yemen, to halt the genocide. We have traumatized an entire generation of Palestinians many of whom have lost their entire families in this, 16 or 17 months now that Israel has been pounding Gaza into rubble. It is virtually rubble at this point. And now, since March 2nd, they've blocked all humanitarian supplies, including all food. So we are seeing increasing cases, not just of malnutrition, but starvation. They cut off the electricity, which means the last desalination plant no longer works. So there's no clean water. People are camped out next to fetid pools of sewage. Disease is rampant. The hospitals not only don't work and don't have any medicine or supplies or very, very little, but they're being routinely attacked. Al-Ahli was bombed with a missile not long ago. So the Arab, especially a Palestinian, they don't have an air force. They don't have mechanized units. They don't have a navy. They don't have the ability to stem, they will strike back through terrorism. I think it's just a question of when. And that will be a gift. If it's on especially an American target, but especially on American soil, that will be a gift to the Trump administration. And they will do, as you correctly point out, exactly what the Nazis did after the Reichstag fire. They used the Reichstag fire. This was the burning of the German parliament. They use that as a way to just round up the entire opposition, including in Nazi Germany, executions. But they shut down the KDP, which was the Communist Party. That was the only real rival party. But they also went after the socialists, journalists. And I think that Trump has already eviscerated civil liberties it doesn't matter whether people have legal status, that green cards, or whether they're here on student visas. They're being rounded up. We're talking about in the hundreds, detained and deported. They ridicule the whole concept of due process. And if there is an event like that, then I think at that point, the iron gates will close. And we will be left with a very frightening, our own kind of autocracy, very similar to Putin's Russia or Narendra Modi's India or Viktor Orban's Hungary. I mean, that's what we'll become. And it could happen very swiftly.
Well, let me following up on that. Professor Jason Stanley, recently quit his job at Yale as a professor of history with an expertise on fascism. He took a job in Ontario, and he's in exile, reminiscent of professors from Germany who came here in the 30s. You've commented that he left because, quote unquote, he knew what was coming. So further to your last answer, what do you think is coming here? How may it most likely unfold?
Well, we know what the intent of the Trump administration is, and that is to create a despotic state, a kind of form of crony capitalism in which a small oligarchic class, a predatory oligarchic class, just does whatever they want to the rest of us. Unions will be shut down. His assault on the press, we're watching him try to destroy the universities now. Universities, all autocracies target universities, by the way. Erdogan did in Turkey, Putin did in Russia. That's classic. And of course, the fascists did in Germany, Stalin did in the Soviet Union, because the universities are traditionally in an open society, sacrosanct in a sense of that is where you debate and discuss ideas. Once that's shut down, after the 1979 overthrow of the Shah, and the Shah ran a very despotic state, but Khomeini and the mullahs also made war on the universities, largely because the communist left, which had been an important element in carrying out the strikes and protests that had brought down the Shah, that was where they were centered. And that was seen as a rival center of power. So Jason Stanley, who I know, I think he's right. He didn't leave because he said he was being persecuted. He wasn't. He left because he sees what's coming, and I don't see anything to dissuade me from his analysis. Yeah, I'm not leaving. I mean, I will leave if I have to leave, but that's not a decision I'm going to make because I want to fight as long as I can. But the inability to essentially confront Trump, I mean, if you have courts, you have some judges who are making rulings that attempt to impose the rule of law. But if the Department of Justice, led by Pam Bondi, refuses to enforce it, then there's no mechanism. It doesn't matter what the courts rule. And that's very frightening. The fact that the FBI is, we can have a whole show on the nefarious activities of the FBI, which you know as well as I do. But nevertheless, when the FBI just becomes a kind of, that it's a matter of loyalty oaths to Trump, and is used to carry out his kind of vendettas against people he defines as opponents. And I think what's most disturbing is ICE, the Immigration Enforcement Service, because ICE is not mandated to detain, hold, and deport people who are here on valid visas or people who have green cards. And ICE is, and there's been a huge transfer since Trump came to power of people within DHS and other into ICE. So he's building ICE up as a kind of form of the Gestapo or the NKVD or something. And that is really scary because these ICE agents, look, I worked in Augusto Pinochet's Chile, and I watched during street demonstrations, unmarked cars, plain clothes, secret police, their faces covered, and just essentially kidnap people, shove them in the cars, and disappear them. And we're already watching that now in the streets of American cities.
Chris, the repression at universities under the false pretext of combating anti-Semitism has been very effective. Catherine Franke talks about the success of the Trump administration at Columbia, where they can now dictate curriculum and who teaches it. The Columbia administration has assisted ICE in abducting student leaders of an anti-Palestinian genocide encampment. You spoke with Catherine, a fired law professor at Columbia, about this. What were the essential points that she made? And I'm sure you agree with them.
Yes. I mean, Catherine Franke is, as you know, a major legal scholar, taught at Columbia Law School for 25 years, spoke out against the repression that was carried out, university-sanctioned repression against students, including calling New York City police onto the campus three times. We're talking about nonviolent protest, arresting over 100 students. And Columbia, decided that they would grovel. I mean, the whole House hearings hearings that were carried out against the three presidents of MIT, University of Pennsylvania, and Columbia, they didn't stand up and denounce the apartheid state of Israel or the egregious abuses on the part of the police on college campuses. They just didn't grovel enough. And of course, Claudia Gay at Harvard and the president of the University of Penn, they lost their jobs. So Franke spoke out, and she was terminated after 25 years at the law school. She, of course, condemned the acquiescence. Now, you know, the people who run these universities, and I've taught at Columbia, I went to Harvard, their sole job, they're all hedge fund managers or private equity firm managers or big bankers or whatever, you know, billionaires. They see that they don't understand education. I don't think they have any real loyalty to the importance or concept of independent educational institutions. It's just about protecting the endowment. And so they groveled. They acquiesced to these outrageous demands, including putting the Middle Eastern Department under receivership in the hopes that the $400 million that in grants that had been withheld would be released. And of course, it didn't work because this isn't a conversation in good faith. The effort by the Trump administration and those around him is to destroy the universities. In fact, Columbia then got hit with more punitive restrictions. Then they sent this outrageous letter to Harvard. That was kind of good because Harvard was already playing the game. It had shut down a Middle East department and, acquiesced to these, I think, completely mendacious charges of anti-Semitism. And then they sent this letter that would have eviscerated any independent control. Vetting faculty and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, their battle will be through the courts. And again, it raises that question of if there's no enforcement, what happens next? So, yeah, and I encourage everybody to watch the interview I did with Catherine Franke and the interview I did with Jason Stanley. I think when you watch those two interviews, you're going to get a very sobering and, I think, realistic sense of where we are.
Well, what has happened with Harvard is a brighter note, because last week Harvard refused to knuckle under to Trump's demands to, well, take over what it's taught and by whom at Harvard, despite the fact that Trump threatened to, well, among other things, cut off $2.2 billion in grants. How important is Harvard's resistance to Trump? Do you think it may encourage other colleges to get on board, resist Trump's fascist demands?
I think Harvard's resistance is very important. And I think that if Harvard fails, we're all in very big trouble. For instance, can the Trump administration, as it apparently wants to, weaponize the IRS to revoke Harvard's tax-free status? You know, can they, as apparently they are doing, block all foreign students from attending Harvard? I mean, this has really become a war. Harvard is a very powerful institution, of course. And if they can take down Harvard, or if they can cripple and destroy Harvard, that's very, very ominous, not only for other universities, but for the rest of us. You have had the presidents, I think, 100 colleges or something, have signed a letter denouncing this assault. So, yes, I would say that if Harvard can stand up to this, it does present a kind of bulwark against this emergent, I would call it Christian fascism or authoritarianism, whatever you want to call it. But boy, if Harvard fails, it's going to be really bad.
Chris, you've said your hope lies in the power of labor. and you speak about the effectiveness of a general strike, but do you see any evidence that the U.S. labor movement is likely to call for a general strike?
No, but I think that is the only mechanism we have left to thwart the very rapid rise of this autocracy, and that is the strike. The oligarchic class, the billionaire class, since the early 70s has made war on labor. They've destroyed labor unions, and then even in the public sector, they've revoked the right to strike. That we saw that with the railroad freight workers when they attempted to negotiate. And they're really the labor conditions on these freight trains is appalling. Skeleton crews and tremendous overtime, safety issues, etc. But under the Biden administration, he revoked that provision that prevented them from striking. But it is the strike. Now, that is the that is the most important mechanism we have to thwart, this rapid reconfiguration of the country into a squalid little dictatorship. But the unions have been crippled. The labor movement has been crippled. And many of those unions, Sean Fain, others, have essentially sold their souls to one of the two parties. I mean, the Democrats are as responsible for where we ended up as the Republicans, of course. And so, I think that what hope there is will come out of militant labor activity. Shama Sawant is, of course, attempting this with Workers Strike Back. I'm a huge supporter of her and Workers Strike Back and went out to Seattle to speak for them. But that, you know, it's not going to be, we're not going to vote this out of office. You know, we're going to have to use the numbers that we have to begin to cripple and disrupt the machinery of government, the machinery of commerce. Short of that, I don't see how, you know, we're going to stop what's happening.
Well, in that regard, Chris, there is not some hopeful signs? Unlike, I'm thinking, of the first 100 days, for example, of Hitler's regime, we didn't see what we've seen on the streets of Germany, what we're now seeing on the streets of America. April 5th occurred in every state in the country, estimated number more than 3-4 million people in the streets, followed up 2 weeks later. This weekend, again, they're calling for huge demonstrations all across the country. How important is this growing, happily growing rather fast, I would suggest, movement of people in the streets? Do you see it as the beginning of a sustained movement that will be exactly what I think you were just calling for in your last answer?
Well, first of all, there was quite a bit of opposition to Hitler initially, certainly until the Reichstag fire. And I remember reading Victor Klemperer, I Will Bear Witness, his diary of the Nazi years, and he lived in Leipzig. He talked about how 100,000 people poured out into the streets in Leipzig, but the leadership of the Social Democrats got into cars and fled to Switzerland. So there was opposition, and there was opposition in the courts, too. A very similar kind of process where essentially the court control of the courts were given over to the Nazi party. So while you may have had courageous judges that would rule to uphold the rule of law, it was, again, not enforced. I think it's great that people are going out into the streets. I think it's important. But I would say that until those mass protests become protests that essentially to disrupt the machine, it isn't going to make any difference. Despotic states don't really care about popular will at all, of course. I mean, neither does the Democratic Party. 77% of registered Democrats wanted an arms embargo against Israel and opposed the genocide. It didn't make any difference to Harris or Biden or anyone else. So I think, again, it is will this evolve into a more militant protest movement that seeks to disrupt? At that point, there's hope. If it is, you know, simple demonstrations, expressions of displeasure that don't disrupt, I don't know how effective it's going to be.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Chris Hedges. Chris, Bernie Sanders and AOC have been on an anti-oligarchy tour across the country, and they've attracted large crowds. But we understand that you do not believe voting for Democrats will help us. Why do you contend that this is the case? And do you think the Democratic Party victory in 2026 congressional elections might serve to curb Trump's fascist pursuits?
Not really. I mean, the Democratic Party is a corpse. It doesn't even function as a genuine political party in the sense that the base has no real voice in the nominees. I mean, Bernie should have won. when he was running, and the Democratic Party and the billionaire class, the donors to, you know, Lloyd Blankfein, all these figures made sure he wouldn't run. I mean, without that corporate money, these figures like Harris or Clinton wouldn't have any support. The Congress is essentially, especially after 2010 and Citizens United, it's just a form of legalized bribery. The political system is so decayed that I don't find our hope in the Democratic Party, and I don't understand this constant effort on the part of AOC and Bernie to channel people back into the party. This is part of the problem. So, you know, Bernie runs his political revolution, and then Clinton becomes the nominee, and then he's going around telling everyone to vote for Clinton. Boy, if you're a member of the working class and part of my family in Maine comes out of the working class, you're never going to vote for Clinton. They remember NAFTA. I mean, the mill towns that my family comes from in Maine are wastelands, as is basically everywhere in post-industrial America. And we should have walked out of the Democratic Party in 1994 when they signed NAFTA. 1996, Bernie was campaigning for Clinton. He knew what NAFTA had done, 30 million mass layoffs. No, I don't see any hope in the Democratic Party at all. And you've seen how supine it is in the face of this shredding before our eyes, very public shredding of the Constitution. I mean, you know, the poor guy down in who was deported to El Salvador, which they admit was administrative error, they said he's not coming back. They don't care. Trump is talking about how he should be able to deport immigrants without sending them to trial. I mean, this is fascism. This is autocracy. This is a dictatorship. And the Democratic Party is, again, go back to Weimar Germany. The opposition was bankrupt, corrupt, and ineffectual, and so is the Democratic Party.
Well, Chris, time is getting short, sadly, for the show. Before we have to let you go, given what you've said about the Democratic Party and what you've said about the protests in the streets being of a very peaceful oratorical format right now, what do you believe people are going to have to be doing down the road if we're going to prevent the further erosion of constitutional rights and civil liberties in this country and the further growth of fascism?
Well, I think it's inevitable that when you resist and going, I'm not in any way saying people shouldn't go out into the streets. I think it's important. But what it does is when you carry out those acts of resistance, when you express that popular will and the state continues with its activities, then that inevitably, I think, is an educational process, one that, at least among a certain segment of the population, radicalizes them. And I think it's that radicalization, which, you know, we all remember from the 1960s, is important, that we have to begin to recognize that this is a class war, you know, run by a billionaire class that has destroyed our political system and is now dismantling what's left of our very anemic open society to create an oligarchic rule. And as Aristotle said when he talked about oligarchic rule, he said then the only two choices are tyranny or revolution. So I think that my hope is that people begin to understand how malignant this power system is, how dangerous it is, and how important it is for us to take them down, with the understanding that that won't be done through the traditional political mechanisms, and in particular, the Democratic Party.
We've come to an end of our allotted time, but before we let you go, I wanted to ask you a couple of things. One is, you've got a new book coming out about Gaza. What's the title? How can people get it? And secondly, how can people follow your work?
So the new book is A Genocide Foretold. You can follow my shows and my columns, all of my work, on chrishedges.substack.com.
Thank you so much for joining us again here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Israeli-American killing of the Palestinian people living in Gaza is the great moral crime of our times. Gaza is a strip of land 24 miles long and 5 miles wide, situated on the shore of the Mediterranean Sea, immediately south of Israel. It used to have a population of 2.3 million people and was one of the most densely populated areas on the planet. The Palestinian people have been murdered by American-made bombs dropped on them from American planes and American drones for the last year and a half. A short ceasefire was recently unilaterally broken by Israel, which resumed the killing in preparation for the removal of the entire population to the Sudan or the Sinai Desert in Egypt. We speak today with Philip Weiss, who's the founder of Mondo Weiss, a news and opinion website known for its critical perspective on Zionism and the Israeli government policies, as well as its support for Palestinian rights. Weiss is a former mainstream journalist. He launched Mondo Weiss in the mid-2000s as a personal blog before it evolved into a larger platform. His background includes work with publications like the New York Observer and Esquire magazine. Over time, Mondo Weiss has built a team of contributors and has become a significant voice in progressive circles when it comes to Middle Eastern politics. Phil Weiss, a hearty, warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Phil, as I see it, the current history of Israel and Palestine can be personified by telling your story and telling Jared Kushner's story. But let's talk about Jared Kushner first. You worked for Kushner when he owned the New York Observer. Please talk about him as a Zionist, his connection with the Netanyahu family, and when he owned the New York Observer newspaper where you worked for a time, you and Kushner had an altercation, I believe. Kushner became part of the Trump family. He married Ivanka Trump, Trump's daughter. What role did he play in the Trump grouping when he helped Israel consolidate its power in the Middle East?
Well, I think Kushner is emblematic of that kind of conservative and religious impulse in the United States among American Jewry to support Israel no matter what. He was religious at Harvard, where he met Alan Dershowitz, or certainly was involved with Alan Dershowitz. He was from a political family in New Jersey that was close to the former governor. And Netanyahu had slept in the Kushner house when he came to visit, because the Kushners were so important in supporting pro-Israel causes. And when he bought the New York Observer, he didn't have to turn it into a Zionist organ. My editor there was already a Zionist, Peter Kaplan, but he doubled down on the Zionism. And shortly after he got there in 2006 or so, he fired me because I called Israel an apartheid state back in 2006, as a columnist there. My proudest moment, I suppose.
I'll say, Phil, with respect to your own political development, at one time when you were working for Kushner, talk about the story behind your working there and your leaving, and how your views on Israel began developing after you visited Israel and then you left the New York Observer.
Right. I think that I'm typical of, certain members of my generation, in that I became radicalized by Israel and Palestine and what I saw there. I had the sense, I was a member of the elite when I was at the New York Observer. I graduated from Harvard. My Harvard set had taken care of me, had gotten me great jobs in journalism in New York. And then I saw during the Iraq War that elite sided with this criminal war, the Iraq War, and there was no dissent on it, really, no substantial dissent on it within the media. And that, my disaffection began. And then I began as a columnist then. I was then in my early 50s or approaching 50. I began to look at the reasons that we were going into that war. And one reason was our support for Israel, the United States support for Israel, something that I had put off all my life. The American-Jewish relationship with Israel, I've been told by my neocon betters, my friends, even at Harvard, I've been told, stay away from the issue. You don't understand it. You've never been there. You have a comfortable, good life here. We got this. We're taking care of it. By 2005, I had begun to look seriously at the American-Jewish relationship to Israel in terms of supporting Israel inside the power structure here. And step by step, I became an anti-Zionist.
Phil Weiss, The ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people living in Gaza is the great crime of our time. The overwhelming and displacing of the native Palestinians was always a central tenet of the white European founders of Zionism a century ago. How did you come to learn all of this?
Slowly, because there was such blindness about this, and still is blindness about this in the American establishment. And of course, there were taboos. And today we see what Trump is doing to pro-Palestinian voices. But I think it was a very slow process. And Michael Ratner, was one of the bravest leaders on this issue, as you know. He had a map of Israel painted on his wall in Cleveland as a boy. He went there. He thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And he accepted the news that Israel was an apartheid state when he was in his 50s or so. And then he went over and saw for himself. That type of bravery is very absent in the Jewish community by and large. There's a doctrinaire obedience to so the idea of supporting Israel, and there's a communal command to support Israel. But it's taken free thinkers, what we call in Hebrew apikoros, like Michael Ratner, to lead our community out of this. And it's going to take a long time, but it happened for me bit by bit. Michael played a role. You played a role. Palestinians obviously played a role. I remember in 06 when I met my first real Palestinian or friendship with a Palestinian, we were walking up Broadway one night, and he said, my goal in life is to end Zionism. And I called him the next day and said, hey, Saif, I want to quote you on this. And he said, no, I'm a grad student. You're going to kill my career. So there's a huge taboo against this awareness. But I think that was 19 years ago that you could end your career by saying you were against Zionism. Well, Palestinians obviously can get deported for that, but that the awareness is broad inside America that Zionism is racism.
Phil, you're on a leave of absence from Mondo Weiss, and you're working on a book. Please tell us about the book you're working on.
Well, I'm approaching 70, and I'm reflecting on my own upbringing and my own journey, and I'm aware that when you look back on the American relationship with Zionism, it took works of the imagination, like Exodus by Leon Uris, who went to my high school in Baltimore. It took works of the imagination to help America, quote unquote, fall in love with Israel. And it's going to take works of the imagination to help Americans escape Israel and fall in love with Palestinians and see the Palestinian story as the more compelling story, the most important story here, and a story that recalls other great freedom struggles. So I am trying to look back on my past inside that elite journalistic life, that Harvard life, that Jewish life, and I am trying to write my own social history of my life as a young man with my friends, many of whom became Zionists, and I'm trying to understand why they became Zionists and why I became an anti-Zionist, and tell the story not in a polemical or ideological or intellectual manner, but in as a social history, and get people to understand why Jews fell for Zionism and why it's so essential that they fall out with Zionism.
Phil, your alma mater, Harvard, has resisted Trump's demands on a university. Trump began his attempt to take control over universities by getting Columbia to agree on allowing the Trump administration to encroach on its autonomy. He got an agreement about what's taught there and who's going to teach it. Trump demands against Harvard are even worse than the ones he made against Columbia. But Harvard said no. How do you appreciate that?
You know, I appreciate it somewhat. But I think that if you look at Garber's statements on this, the recent statements on this from Harvard, they're pretty dismaying. I mean, they say, yeah, they're going to stand up to Trump, but their own board of overseers includes many big donors who are saying, we agree with you, there's an anti-Semitism problem, and we got to throw the Palestinians under the bus, but just the same, we're not going to get dictated to by the Trump administration. So I think that in the press, you can see some of these statements that are very dismaying from Harvard that suggest that they are willing to make concessions on the Palestinian front. I admire Harvard general overall on this. I think they did a great thing by issuing that refusal to Trump. Garber, the president, did. But the problem is the devil is in the details, and they really are willing to sell Palestinians out.
Now, Harvard has the biggest endowment of all universities in the country, $58 billion. But think about this. Musk has a personal fortune seven times as large. So I think when Harvard gets into a fight with the government, it's not an equal fight, is it?
No, it's not. But I mean, Michael, you just pointed, you know, they presumably, you know, have the wherewithal to take the government on. But their board of overseers is conservative and is worried about the financial cost to them of doing so, just as Columbia cut and run on this because of financial concerns. So I don't credit Harvard with the most idealistic motives here.
Yeah, neither do I. But let's move on. I want to talk to you about the Israeli lobby, Phil. Years ago, you held your first fundraiser for Mondo Weiss. I was there. I remember it. Professor Stephen Walt, who had co-written the book, a groundbreaking book on the Israeli lobby, gave the fundraising pitch. The lobby gives money to 232 Congress people. The war against the Palestinian people in Gaza has been fought by using American planes, American bombs, American money, and American diplomatic cover. Please talk about the power of the lobby.
Obviously, there are different theories about why America is supporting a genocide. And my view is that when you talk about Democrats, the way that Democrats completely folded on this issue, including good liberals like Cory Booker, Murphy in Connecticut, or the Delaware senators, Maryland senators, they refuse to cut off aid. They are the ones who are bombing Palestinians, truly. And, you know, Nicholas Kristof, in one of the greatest sort of Orwellian statements I've ever heard, wrote a column recently, said, is this the best use of American military aid? How can anyone even raise that question, Michael? As you said at the beginning of this discussion, this is the great moral question of our time. It's an easy question. It's not hard to see that bombing children, shredding children, trapping mothers under rubble, you know, it moved the Pope's heart. The Pope was moved by this, I think, a wonderful, simple man at heart. He understood the enormity of this atrocity. You understand it. I understand it. Nicholas Kristof at the New York Times wonders about it. Senator Murphy in Connecticut wonders about it. And so why do they wonder about this? I think that they wonder about this because of the importance of the pro-Israel Jewish community inside the Democratic Party. I'm not talking about Christian Zionists here. I'm talking about the traditional Democratic coalition, which was included several components. Principally, it included blacks and Jews and people of color and labor. And that coalition has come under assault, and I mean, it's eroded in a lot of ways, but that central sort of bond between blacks and Jews that was at the heart of the party continues to be important. And I think that is the reason that Hakeem Jeffries said, the leader of the House Minority Leader, said during one of the many Gaza massacres, he stood outside the UN and said, Israel today, Israel tomorrow, Israel forever, echoing George Wallace's speech in the State House door during segregation, just as abominable as George Wallace's statement, maybe even more abominable. But he does it because of the importance of the Jewish power structure inside the Democratic Party as fundraisers, as principals inside the party. And so ultimately, I think I'm not going to do the math on that right now, but there are various estimates that Jews make up half to three quarters of Democratic fundraising, typically. People who are raising money for Congress in the middle of nowhere, the first place they go for foreign policy statement at J Street, the head of Emily's List said that the first place she went when she was raising money for congressional candidates was she went to the Jewish community, and that meant going to AIPAC for a statement on foreign policy. That's the way it works. That's the simple math of the question. And so to this day, people like Hakeem Jeffries are not going to turn their back on Israel in any fashion. And the most reasonable statement in the world, which is Bernie Sanders, a great American Jew, Bernie Sanders' statement that we must cut off military funding to Israel because they are killing babies. That kind of stance is rejected by the Democratic Party. I think it's because of the lobby. Now, obviously, there are cultural elements to this. I mentioned Leon Uris and Exodus. That's a fable inside the American establishment that was embraced by the American establishment. But other fables have been rejected. And I think there are good material reasons why this fable has not been rejected. And ultimately, where my work goes is inside the Jewish community, because I think the Jewish community will always be an influential community in the American power structure and American society. It's the nature of our society, and I love that about it. It's how I gained a lot of what prominence I had came through that community. I love that community, but we have to reform the Jewish community. Michael Ratner felt that way. I know you feel that way, Michael, and I feel that urgently, that this is where anti-Zionism really has to gain traction, is inside the Jewish community, because it has so much influence over foreign policy.
This is Michael Smith. I'm here with my guest, Phil Weiss from Mondo Weiss. We're talking about the current situation in the United States with respect to Gaza. Phil, President Donald Trump and his co-war criminal Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu recently met at the White House. Trump talked about clearing out the 2 million people still alive in Gaza and his intention of building a Riviera on the Mediterranean. The Gazans are starving and sick. The bombing continues. It's been reported that 100 children are dying every day. It's hard to even appreciate all of this, isn't it? What do you think is going to happen? How is this going to end?
I think that where it will end, you know, Michael, you and I are progressives, so I think that we believe it will end ultimately with the liberation of the Palestinian people, you know, that a Palestine must be free. You cannot oppress people like this. And so that obviously is a vision that is further from reality than ever right now, when you have these racists not just plotting ethnic cleansing, carrying out ethnic cleansing before our eyes with the American support and Democratic Party support. But I think what's hopeful about this moment is that it is so grotesque, it is so plain, that no one can deny that Palestine is at the center of American politics anymore. It played an important part in Donald Trump's election. A lot of Democrats stayed home because they were so sickened by Biden's docility in the face of a genocide, his inability to do anything to cut off these bombs that were killing Palestinian children and civilians. And I think that that's so plain that it's, you remember Lucy Ann Goldberg, she once said that, I remember her saying that when Bill Clinton said, "I did not have sex with that woman," he had drunk the strontium 90 and he was going to kill him in the end. Now, obviously, she was trying to destroy the Clinton presidency, and it's not the best analogy, but I think in this case, the strontium 90, our leaders have drunk the strontium 90 when they deny genocide, which is plain to all these young people. See what's going on. Anybody sees the enormity of this. And I think that what's going to happen is that this has obviously become a huge issue for progressives. It's a huge issue for the Trump administration. The Democrats are trying to brush it under the rug and say it has nothing to do with why we're losing. It has nothing. We're doing the right thing. And they have the liberal media saying, they're trying to get some cancer victims out of Gaza into Tel Aviv hospital. Isn't that wonderful? That kind of BS. is going on inside the establishment, but everyone sees what's going on, is that this is a human-made genocide. It just gets worse, as you say, every day with the reports of the diseases that are rampant. The people are living in tents. And it's at last, this is in the news in America, and it's in the news in a way that is angering young people. And I hear people saying, you know, people are free now. At last, some people are free to hate Israel. And it's you're allowed to hate Elon Musk in the media. You're allowed to hate Russia. You're allowed to hate all these bad actors. But if you hate Israel, then you're an anti-Semite. I think that that prohibition is crumbling before our eyes because what they are doing is so hateful.
Phil, when Jews like yourself speak out against the crimes of Zionism, you're called a self-hater. Zionists conflate Israel as a Jewish state with the Jewish religion and the Jewish people. They support cracking down on civil liberties and university autonomy as necessary to protect Jewish students who they say feel unsafe. What do you think about this?
Well, I think that first I have to get off the line. Max Blumenthal's great joke. I've got a lot better reasons to hate myself than the fact that I don't like Israel. So it's absurd to say that I'm a self-hating Jew because I don't like Israel. I think what we are trying to save, the Jewish community, because the Jewish community has gone so off the rails on this. And in fact, they are the ones who are promoting anti-Semitism because they are saying to be Jewish. They are defining Judaism now. They're as the support for Israel and love of Israel. So they are telling the world and insisting to the world that to be Jewish means to want to kill Palestinian children. And it's explicit in statements that come out of Israel. It's just explicit, and the genocidal statements out of the leaders of Israel, which and the people of Israel, which are not covered in the American press, are explicit that to be a Zionist is to support this war against the Palestinian people, uprooting the Palestinian people, forcing them off their land. And the world sees this, and the world thinks that this is Judaism. Then I don't like Judaism. And this issue was raised by Hannah Arendt 80 years ago, that you are going to foster anti-Semitism by causing an identification of Zionism with Judaism, which are two totally separate things. You are going to force this identification. People are going to see it, and they're going to hate the Jews. And Nathan Glazer, the great sociologist at Harvard, said this, and it was a statement. I think it was Brian Klug, the philosopher at J Street, said the same. You were going to foster, we're putting Jews in a precarious position by supporting apartheid. Judaism means supporting apartheid, then people are going to hate Judaism. And recently that argument, which I've made for many years, was in New York Magazine from a columnist. So I think this awareness is growing inside the Jewish community of the great danger of allying yourself with apartheid and calling it a religious cause or calling it a religion.
Phil, what can our listeners do to support the Palestinians?
I think that they can speak out. I think that's the most important thing, is to speak out about Palestinian human rights, to support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. You know, again and again in the history of this country, we see the importance of boycott. We just saw it. The boycott is playing a role right now in the resistance to Trump because people are boycotting Tesla cars. And that's completely honorable. And I think that Elon Musk has killed far fewer children. I'm not completely sure of this, but my sense is that he has far less culpability than Israel does in terms of the killing of children. And yet we're not allowed to boycott Israel. Of course we should be boycotting Israel. And so people by support Palestinians by supporting the boycott of Israeli products.
Thank you very much, Phil. I want to say something about you and Jackie Robinson. The comment about Jackie Robinson was that he was a credit to his race, the human race. And I think you're a credit to all of us. I really appreciate your being on Law and Disorder. But before you go, Phil, let me ask, how can people learn about Mondo Weiss and get Mondo Weiss? And how can people get your writings?
They should go to MondoWeiss.net and they can sign up for our daily newsletters. That's what I tell them to do. Subscribe to MondoWeiss.net. It's free, but we can always use donations. I'm a senior editor there, and my writings are on there from last year. I haven't done any writing lately. I expect to be, this issue, as you know, is just too important for Jews of conscience to remain silent. So I thank you, Michael, for your leadership on this issue. You have been ahead of me on this, and you understood this years before I did. You had clarity about it, and you saw through the BS, and I know that you led your friend Michael Ratner on this question, too.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Phil, before I say goodbye. I'm older than you are, so I remember the war in Vietnam. I was active in opposing it. And I remember in 1967 that Israel came out in support of the American war in Vietnam. And that was the beginning of my understanding of the real nature of Israel. Phil Weiss, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we continue to monitor the dismantling of fundamental constitutional protections and laws by the Trump administration.
We're joined by Dalia Taha, policy manager at the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where she leads the First Amendment and civil liberties work.
We then speak with author and anthropologist David Vine about his recent book, Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World.
Our guest contends that more than 800 U.S. military installations scattered across foreign lands are not merely symbols of strength, they're often sources of harm, fostering anti-American resentment and propping up authoritarian regimes.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
America is in the midst of a constitutional crisis. Over 200 lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration during his first 100 days in office, resulting in over 100 injunctions and stays as Trump lays waste to fundamental constitutional protections and laws passed by Congress. On his first day in office on the second term, Donald Trump had the audacity to sign an executive order claiming he was, quote, restoring freedom of speech. Instead, his administration is systematically destroying the right to speak freely, to write freely, to dissent freely, and to protest freely. Trump ordered the elimination of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies in both the public and private spheres, and targeted several leading universities, threatening to withhold federal funding for indoctrinating students with woke ideology, and for failing to combat anti-Semitism, by which he means criticism of Israel. He shut down the Voice of America and the Smithsonian Museum. He canceled the security clearances, government contracts, and access to federal buildings of several prominent law firms because he didn't like the clients they represent. He even excluded the Associated Press from the White House because it refused to call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. In one of the most egregious violations of the First Amendment, the Trump administration canceled foreign student visas and deported legal permanent residents claiming their constitutionally protected campus protests were contrary to U.S. foreign policy interests. Fortunately, brilliant lawyers, courageous judges, and public interest organizations are fighting back. To discuss these critical issues, we're joined today by Dalia Taha, a policy manager at the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where she leads the First Amendment and civil liberties work. Dalia is a Palestinian-American Muslim. Prior to joining MPAC, she served as project manager at the Texas A&M Foundation, where she researched and analyzed maternal health policy. At MPAC, Dalia works to champion policies and initiatives that uplift and advocate for the Muslim community nationwide, with a particular focus on protecting the First Amendment, academic institutions, and the next generation of American Muslims. I am particularly pleased to have Dalia with us today because she and I are about to launch a podcast called Rapid Response, sponsored by MPAC, in which we will examine the struggle of students and community members, Muslims, Jews, and allies who have been targeted by the Trump administration for expressing political views in favor of Palestinian rights and sovereignty, which the government is seeking to suppress. Dalia, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Steve, for that amazing introduction and for having me on Law and Disorder. I'm very excited to be here today.
We're excited, too. Let's begin with what's happening on campuses. Over the last year, pro-Palestinian students across the country have been arrested, doxxed, suspended, and even threatened with deportation. How is MPAC defending the First Amendment rights of students and faculty members who are being silenced or punished simply for speaking out against Israel's assault on Gaza?
At the Muslim Public.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I didn't know that this morning when I woke up that I'll be in this detention facility here, that I would end up incarcerated for something that I believe is my democratic right to show up and speak out against what I think was happening there, a violation of city and state laws, and a lack of transparency.
That's Newark Mayor Ross Baraka, the mayor of the largest city in New Jersey. He was arrested Friday and detained by masked federal immigration police when he joined three Democratic Congress members set to tour a newly reopened private 1,000-bed Immigration and Customs Enforcement jail. We'll speak to Mayor Baraka, as well as one of the three New Jersey Congress members who tried to prevent his arrest, Representative Bonnie Watson Coleman. The 80-year-old cancer survivor now faces arrest herself. Then to Abubakar Abed, the 22-year-old Palestinian accidental war correspondent. We last spoke to him in Gaza, suffering from malnutrition.
There's no food available. A lot of people are being taken to the hospital to receive treatment where doctors cannot really give the proper treatment for them, and the medications are not available. Israel has been blocking the two crossings, not allowing a trickle, a one single track into Gaza. And that has really left people on the cusp of imminent death.
As hunger engulfs the Gaza Strip due to Israel's total blockade on aid, we speak with Abubakar Abed in Dublin, Ireland, which has given him a scholarship to study as he heals. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A leading global hunger monitor is warning Gaza's entire population is facing a critical risk of famine, with over 500,000 Palestinians already facing starvation. The report by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification comes as Israel's full blockade of Gaza enters its 10th week. Over the weekend, Israel carried out numerous strikes across the Gaza Strip. Earlier today, Israel bombed a school-turned shelter in the Jabalia area, killing 12 Palestinians, including at least 5 children and 4 women. Meanwhile, a United Nations Special Committee has warned the world could be witnessing, quote, another Nakba, as Israel moves to forcibly displace Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Despite the ongoing attacks, Palestinians in Gaza say they refuse to leave their homes.
We will not immigrate from Gaza, no matter how difficult the circumstances. Even if there's killings, even if there's bombings, if there's no medicine, no food, nothing to drink, no clothing and no shelter, we are not leaving the Gaza Strip. If they are betting on our departure, no, the world might vanish, leave, the fish might migrate from the sea, but we will not immigrate.
At the time of this broadcast, Hamas is about to release the Israeli-American hostage Idan Alexander following direct negotiations with the Trump administration. Alexander is believed to be the last living American hostage in Gaza. In his first Sunday address, Pope Leo XIV called for a ceasefire in Gaza and Ukraine as part of a broader anti-war message. The Pope spoke from the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica.
I am deeply saddened by what is happening in the Gaza Strip. Let the fire cease immediately. Let humanitarian aid be provided to the exhausted civilian population, and may all hostages be freed.
A U.S.-brokered ceasefire between India and Pakistan continues to hold following the worst outbreak in fighting in decades between the two nuclear countries over Kashmir. President Trump announced the ceasefire Saturday. Top military officials from India and Pakistan are expected to speak today. During 4 days of fighting, dozens of people were reportedly killed on both sides. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has challenged Russian President Vladimir Putin to meet him Thursday in Istanbul, Turkey, for face-to-face peace talks. Zelensky made the announcement Sunday.
I will be in Turkey this Thursday, May 15th, and I'm expecting Putin in Turkey, personally. I hope this time Putin will not look for reasons why he can't do something. We are ready to talk to end the war, Thursday, Turkey. President Trump supported it. All leaders support it.
This comes as a group of European nations have called for Russia to immediately agree to a 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine or face new sanctions. The Trump administration initially appeared to support the European proposal, but on Sunday, President Trump backed away from it. The Kremlin has not said if Putin has plans to go to Turkey Thursday. In news from Washington, D.C., House Republicans have released a plan for sweeping cuts to Medicaid to help cover the cost of $4.5 trillion in tax breaks for the rich. The Congressional Budget Office projects the $880 billion in cuts would cause 8.6 million people to become uninsured. Part of the Republican plan also calls for new work requirements for many Medicaid recipients. Senator Bernie Sanders responded by writing, quote, "This is what oligarchy is about. The very rich get richer. The poor lose health care. Outrageous," he wrote. On Friday, federal agents arrested the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, Mayor Ross Baraka, on trespassing charges after he joined a congressional delegation to inspect a privately run ICE immigration jail in Newark owned by GEO Group. Baraka, who's running for New Jersey governor, was held for 5 hours. The Department of Homeland Security has also threatened to arrest the 3 Democratic lawmakers who visited the ICE jail, LaMonica McIver, Bonnie Watson-Coleman, and Rob Menendez. A DHS spokesperson said more arrests are still on the table.
The ACLU of New Jersey described the arrest and threats as a, quote, shameful escalation of the Trump administration's intimidation campaign against officials who refused to do their bidding, unquote. We'll speak to Newark Mayor Ross Baraka and Congressmember Bonnie Watson Coleman after headlines. Mass ICE raids are continuing across the U.S. In Tennessee, over 100 people were arrested in a joint operation between immigration agents and the Highway Patrol. Advocates say the Highway Patrol is aiding federal agents in racially profiling Tennessee residents, intimidating people into self-deporting and stoking fear in immigrant communities. In Worcester, Massachusetts, hundreds of community members gathered Sunday to protest the recent ICE detainment of at least two residents whose arrest has provoked outrage online. Among other things, a video of the chaotic arrest shows police restraining the distressed teenage daughter of an arrested woman, pushing the girl's face to the ground as she screamed. There are mounting reports of ICE raids in California, including in farmworker towns like Oxnard, where federal agents last week surrounded